sell this email address won't work until I get back there on August 7th.
Thanks. So can everyone hear me? Okay. So I'm going to talk about a generalization of the notion of measurement contextuality to preparations. And what I hope to convince you of is that the notion of preparation contextuality, which I'm going to define, is at least as interesting as the notion of measurement contextuality. And so I'm going to do that by giving you a bunch of examples of how there are versions of proofs of preparation contextuality that are very similar to every different kind of proof of measurement contextuality we have. But because there's a limited amount of time, I'm not going to give you the proofs of measurement contextuality, the ones that are already out there. So if you're familiar with them, then you know, you'll see my examples and you'll say, oh yeah, that's analogous to that one. And if you're not familiar with them, then you know, just bear with me and look at these examples of proofs of preparation contextuality, and hopefully you'll think that it's interesting despite not knowing how analogous it is to this previous notion. Okay, so I'm going to start by defining the traditional notion of measurement contextuality. So first I need to tell you about hidden variable theories. So very simply, a deterministic hidden variable theory is one wherein you assign to every quantum state some distribution over a hidden variable state space. And so that distribution should be normalized. And to every measurement, so a basis in the Hilbert space, you assign a set of indicator functions that are idempotent. So they're either 1 or 0. And together, they sum up to the unit function. So if I prepare this state, then in the hidden variable model, what's going on is that really some particular value of lambda is being prepared with these relative probabilities. And then when you do this measurement, you're finding out whether the value of lambda lies in this region, or this region. So if you want to know what's the probability of getting outcome k in this measurement, given this preparation, it's just the integral of one of these functions, the kth function, with that distribution over lambda. And if your hidden variable theory is going to reproduce the predictions of quantum mechanics, then this had better equal the quantum expression for that probability, which is just the overlap of the vector squared. So now you can generalize this to density operators. And again, you're just going to represent those by distributions. And instead of having a basis of vectors, you could have a projected value measure. So some of these projectors could be greater than rank 1. And it's the same model in the hidden variable theory. And now you demand that these integrals give me a trace rho pk. You could generalize this further to effects. But people traditionally don't talk about contextuality for unsharp measurements. Traditionally, the notion of contextuality is only defined for sharp measurements. So, so far, everything I've said has nothing to do with measurement contextuality, but I'm going to get to that right now. So the point is that there can be many ways of measuring a non-rank 1 projective value measure. So imagine the projective value measure that just distinguishes whether the state is psi 1 or whether it's in the plane orthogonal to psi 1. So here are two ways you could do that measurement. You could measure psi 1 versus psi 2 versus psi 3, and then coarse grain the second and the third outcome. Or you could measure some other basis, psi 1, psi 2 prime, psi 3 prime, and coarse grain these two outcomes. So this is the PVM for your original measurement. You coarse grain 2 and 3, which just means you sum those projectors. This is your effective PVM, which just is of this form. And similarly here, you do the coarse graining, and you get exactly the same PVM at the end. So despite the fact that these are really two different measurements, you go to the lab, you do different things, your Stern-Gerlach apparatuses are oriented in different directions. At the end of the day, once you've discarded the information about whether you got outcome 2 or 3, you just ask for the probabilities of this outcome versus this outcome. No matter what preparation you've done beforehand, you find exactly the same probabilities for these two outcomes, whether you did this measurement or the one on the right. So you could say that these two measurements are operationally equivalent. There's no preparation I can do that allows me to distinguish which of these two measurements is occurring. And so I can denote that this way. Measurement M and M prime are operationally equivalent. So the traditional notion of measurement non-contextuality, expressed in a way that perhaps is unfamiliar to you but is equivalent to the standard way, is that if your two measurements are operationally equivalent, then the indicator functions you associate with them, the sets of indicator functions you associate with them, should be the same. So in a slogan, if your two measurements are represented by the same PVM, then they ought to be represented by the same set of indicator functions in your hidden variable theory. That's the idea. It's natural because if you ask, well, why is it that I can't distinguish these two measurements no matter what I prepare ahead of time? A natural answer to that question is, well, the reason you can't distinguish those two measurements is because they're measuring exactly the same property. Maybe you've built them slightly different, but at the end of the day, they're just measurements of the very same property, and that's why you can't tell them apart. And so this encodes that fact. So please interrupt me at any point if something I'm saying is unclear. All right, pictorially, the idea is that you would hope that you could come up with a hidden variable theory wherein if I measured the bases psi1, psi2, psi3, then maybe the characteristic functions look like this. And the only difference when I measure this other basis is that this second region here is split up in a different way. But when I coarse grain these two outcomes here or here, I get exactly the same indicator function, whether I did it this way or this way. So every projector should be associated with the same characteristic function or indicator function, regardless of how you measure that projector. All right, so it's probably well known to this audience that Bell and independently Cochran and Specker proved that non-contextual hidden variable models of quantum theory are impossible in Hilbert spaces of dimensionality 3 or greater. And that's known as the Bell-Cochran-Specker theorem. And I'm not going to give you an example of it. But there are many different versions of the Bell-Cochran-Specker theorem. And I'm going to be giving analogs of different versions. But I now want to point out a similarity between measurements and preparations that's interesting. So the key, in the way I've stated measurement contextuality, or the assumption of measurement non-contextuality, the key fact in these proofs is that there's many ways of decomposing a rank 2 projector into rank 1 projectors. So in the particular example I gave, identity minus psi 1 could be decomposed into this sum of projectors or this sum of projectors. And that was the critical fact that allowed this no-go theorem to be proven. And now if you think about preparation procedures, you have a similar ambiguity. There's a multiplicity of different convex decompositions of a mixed state into pure states. So this is sometimes known as the ambiguity of mixtures. So here's a familiar example. If you take a qubit, the completely mixed state, you can write that as a probability of half projector onto z up, probability of half projector onto z down, or x up, x down. This is the quantum information theorist way of writing those eigenstates. And in fact, you can write it as an equal mixture of any two pure states pointing in opposite directions. And so this seems analogous to this. So you might think, well, and this is also one of those bizarre features of quantum theory that you learn about, and you think there's something kind of non-classical about that. So a natural question to ask is, can you build a no-go theorem out of this somehow? And it's similar to the Cochran-Specker theorem. And so the answer to that question is yes, and that's what I'm going to show you. So I'm now going to define a notion of preparation non-contextuality. And I should say that this generalization of contextuality was born when I was working on trying to summarize what was known about measurement contextuality. And I was working with John Seip on that, who's here at this conference. So John was instrumental in defining this notion of preparation contextuality that I'm about to tell you. OK, so the idea is that suppose you have two preparation procedures, which are associated with the same density operator in the quantum formalism. So for example, the first preparation procedure could be implement some procedure p sub j, which is associated with the state size of j, with probability little p sub j. And then forget which one of those you implemented. Now that whole procedure, put it in a black box, forget what the outcome of the dice roll was, and just get something out of it, is described by this density operator that's the convex sum of those psi j's. A different procedure would be to implement some procedure pj prime, or this, I guess this should be an I, pi prime with probability qi, so this could be a different probability distribution, and these procedures could be associated with different states, chi i's. But if you sum them all up, you get exactly the same density operator. So two different procedures in the lab, they correspond to different things. But no matter what measurement you do following these black boxes, you cannot distinguish them at all, because the density operator encodes all the information about future statistics. So you could say that these things are operationally equivalent, which I can denote this way, p equivalent to p prime. And the assumption now of preparation non-contextuality is analogous to the one for measurement non-contextuality, but it just says that whenever two preparations are operationally equivalent, then you should associate the same distribution over the hidden variables with those two preparations. So the idea is, if I can't distinguish these two preparations in the lab, the reason is that they're spitting out a system, and the distribution over the states of that system is exactly the same in the two cases. And that's why no measurements can separate those two preparation procedures. So pictorially, I can imagine that, you know, I represent each of these psi j's by some distribution. Sorry that this is so rough. With some probabilities, and when I sum them all up, I get some distribution. And then the way I would represent this procedure is just some other set of distributions different from these, with possibly some different weights, but such that when I sum them all up, I get exactly the same thing. That's the idea. Okay, so now I want to show you that in quantum theory, you can't have this kind of hidden variable model. So it's just like was the case for measurements, that you might think this is a natural sort of hidden variable model to ask for, but quantum theory doesn't allow it. So I'm going to show you that a preparation non-contextual hidden variable model is impossible. And then another way of saying that is just that I'm going to prove preparation contextuality. All right. So first of all, I'm going to need to tell you about a couple of features that hidden variable models have to have. So this slide has nothing to do with the assumption of non-contextuality. So suppose that you have two procedures, p and p prime, and they're associated with distributions mu and mu prime. And now suppose that those two procedures are distinguishable with certainty, which means that there is some one-shot measurement I can do that will tell me precisely whether you've prepared p or p prime. So you know, you might put your procedure in a black box and ask me to determine which of the two. And there's some measurement that allows me to always determine which of the two you've implemented. Suppose that's the case. Then I claim the distributions associated with those two procedures in the hidden variable theory have to be disjoint. They can't overlap, like on the left. They have to be non-overlapping, like on the right. Why? Well, suppose they did overlap. Now, of all the measurements that the hidden variable theory might allow, the most powerful measurement you could imagine is one that just tells you precisely what the hidden variable value is. So it tells you exactly where you are on this line. But even if you did that most powerful measurement, you would sometimes get an outcome in this region, which is consistent with both preparations. So when you know that that outcome is going to occur, because for both preparations, it's given some non-zero probability. When you get it, you won't be able to tell whether p or p prime was implemented, because it's consistent with both. And so that would violate our assumption that I can always distinguish p and p prime with certainty. So if you imagine any other measurement, which is not as powerful as this one that determines exactly what lambda is, well, if the most powerful measurement can't distinguish these two things, then any less powerful measurement won't be able to distinguish them either. Yes? In quantum theory, if you imagine the density operator associated with p and with p prime, then their product would be zero. And if they're pure states, they're orthogonal. That's right. So does everyone buy this argument? Is there anyone who objects to this assumption? Good. All right, I need one more assumption, which is how you represent convex combination of preparation procedures. So suppose I implement procedure p with probability little p and p prime with probability 1 minus little p. And that gives me some effective procedure. You know, I forget which of these two I did, put the whole thing in a black box. That gives me an effective procedure, which I call p double prime. And now the claim is that the way you would represent that in the hidden variable model, mu double prime, has to be the convex sum of the way you'd represent p and the way you'd represent p prime. So what's the argument that establishes this? Well, suppose I ask, what's the probability that I'll get a particular hidden variable value out of this implementation of p double prime? Well, I know that with probability little p, you implemented preparation And the probability of getting the value lambda there was mu of lambda. And with probability 1 minus p, you did the other preparation. The probability of getting the hidden variable value lambda was mu prime of lambda. So the overall probability of getting lambda has to be the weighted sum of these two probabilities, which is just that expression. So does everybody buy this assumption? Speak now, because we're going to be deriving contradictions. And then I don't want to hear you say that you didn't buy one of my assumptions. So I take it that these two things are uncontroversial. Hidden variable models should have these features. And so when I move on and then I assume preparation on contextuality drive a contradiction, the problem, yes? Well, you could, but there would be very bizarre sorts of things. So an example would be, suppose that I have these two devices in my lab representing P and P prime. And they, in the hidden variable picture, they put out systems that have some distribution over the states. Now, maybe if I precede the preparation procedure with a roll of a dice, then somehow what came out on the dice might now impact what distribution of hidden variables comes out of this preparation procedure. That's conceivable, that my mere rolling of a dice somehow changes what this preparation procedure is doing. But it seems quite natural to say that the dice roll is independent of what's coming out of the preparation procedure. So that's the sort of assumption that's being made here. Yes? Yes, so the lambda here lives in the hidden variable space for just, I'm imagining that there's some system that gets spit out of this box, like an atom, and lambda describes the hidden variables of that system. If you wanted to, you could now say, well, let me introduce some hidden variables for the whole apparatus, but later when I'm doing measurements, those measurements are just going to be on the atom. And so in a sense, I could marginalize, I could trace over all those other hidden variables and just ask, what's the distribution over lambda? Because that's the thing I'm going to be measuring. OK, so I start with these two assumptions. And now I'm going to give you the proof. It happens in a two-dimensional Hilbert space. And it makes use of just six pure states. So you imagine there's six preparation procedures associated with these six states here. I've drawn them on a plane of the Bloch sphere. They're just the North Pole, the South Pole, and these ones here. And of course, little A is orthogonal to big A, little B is orthogonal to big B, little C is orthogonal to big C. Now, just for convenience, I'm going to rewrite those as density operators. They're still pure states. But now the orthogonality relations can be expressed as products of the density operators being equal to zero, which is nice. Now, note that the procedure P little a and the procedure P big A can be distinguished with certainty because they correspond to orthogonal quantum states. So I know there's a measurement that allows me to retrodict which of those two preparation procedures we've done. It's just the measurement along this axis here. The Z spin measurement if this is a spin half particle. And similarly, little b and big b are distinguishable, little c and big c are distinguishable. So by the first argument I presented on the last slide, the way I represent these things in the hidden variable theory has to be by disjoint distributions. OK, next I want to introduce five more preparation procedures. The first one is just implement p little a with probability half and implement p big a with probability half, and then forget what the outcome of your coin flip was. So that's an effective procedure. Or I could do it with little b and big b, little c and big c. And then I have two more procedures which correspond to taking little a, little b, and little c with probability a third each. So these are all things I can do in the lab. And now I make use of the second fact that I established two slides back, which is that the way you represent these convex combinations in a hidden variable theory is of this form. You just say that the distribution associated with p little a big a is the convex sum of the distribution associated with little a and the distribution associated with big a, and similarly for all the rest. So if you agreed with those two assumptions, you should agree with everything so far. And now here's the bit where the quantum mechanics comes in. Those five preparation procedures I introduced in the quantum formalism are all represented by the same density operator. So if I take an incoherent sum of z up and z down, I get the completely mixed state, identity over 2. But if I take an incoherent sum of this and this with equal probability, I also get the complete mixed state. And similarly for this line, if I take a sum of these three with equal weights, I also get the complete mixed state. So all these sums give me the completely mixed state. And that means that I can't distinguish those five preparation procedures. Although they're different in the lab, if I don't tell you which of the five I've done, you can do all the measurements you'd like. You'll never be able to figure it out. So that's what I called operationally equivalent previously. All those procedures look exactly the same. And so now I apply my assumption of preparation non-contextuality. Any things that are operationally indistinguishable should be represented in the same way in the hidden variable theory. So all these five distributions should actually be the same. I'll just call them nu of lambda. So the equations I derived here, now I just put the same distribution, nu of lambda, on the left-hand side. There, like that. OK, so this is what we have now. Our task is to find six distributions satisfying these equations. These are the disjointness relations. These are the convex relations. And basically, it can't be done. And that's where you get the contradiction. So I'm going to quickly take you through why it can't be done. First, I just note that these parallel the equations that the density operator satisfy, except that these things are functions, not matrices. OK, so first thing we can infer from these three equations is that for every pair, one of the two, so fix the value of lambda, I should say. Fix the value of lambda. Now, one of mu A of lambda and mu big A of lambda has to be 0 at that value of lambda. So one of these two has to be 0, one of these two has to be 0, and one of these two has to be 0. Suppose that it's the first in all three cases. So suppose this is true for that value of lambda. Now plug that into this equation here. You get 0 on the right-hand side. Therefore, nu of lambda is 0 at that value of lambda. But now if you look at this equation, this term is 0, this term is 0. Therefore, mu big A of lambda is 0 at that value of lambda. And similarly here, mu big B will be 0, mu big C will be 0. So everything is 0 at that value of lambda. So that's not very interesting. Consider a different possibility, possible assignments of zeros here. So suppose this one's 0, this one, and mu big C are 0 for a particular value of lambda. Well, now we can plug the first two conditions into this equation here. And I get that nu is a third mu little c, written that here. But if I plug in the fact that mu big C is 0 into this equation, I get that nu is a half mu little c. That's here. And the only way to satisfy these is if mu little c is 0. But now I'm back to mu little a, mu little b, and mu little c all being 0. And so I get the all 0 solution. So at that value of lambda, all of these distributions have to take the value 0. And then it turns out if you stare at this diagram long enough, you realize that these two possible assignments of 0 are basically symmetrically equivalent to any other possible assignments of 0. So these arguments will still apply. And so the point is that any assignment of zeros that satisfies this will yield the all 0 solution. But these were supposed to be normalized probability distributions. So they can't be 0 everywhere. So we have a contradiction. That's it. You can now ask, well, that's cute. You have something that looks like maybe a bit analogous to one of those finite ray proofs of measurement contextuality, wherein you don't have to appeal to a particular state. You just look at the structure of measurements, and you make your assumption of non-contextuality and derive a contradiction. That seems to be what we have here. And you could ask, well, what about all the other sorts of proofs you could come up with of measurement contextuality? Are there analogs here? So for instance, you can derive proof of measurement contextuality from Gleason's theorem. So you might ask, is there anything similar to that in the context of preparation contextuality? And there is. So that's what I'm going to tell you about now. So let me first review what Gleason's theorem is. It says that if you have a function on the space of all projectors, I'll call it omega, which satisfies the following three conditions. The first is that it's the value of the function is between 0 and 1. The second is that it takes identity to 1. And the third is that the function acting on a sum of projectors is just the sum of the function acting on each projector. So this is a natural set of assumptions to make for what the probability, if I think of that projector as a measurement outcome, what the probability of that measurement outcome is for any given preparation procedure. It's natural that it should satisfy these features, it should be a probability. If I do the trivial measurement, I should always get the yes outcome. And if I coarse grain outcomes, then the probability of the coarse grain outcome should be the sums of the probabilities of the individual outcomes. And now what Gleason was able to prove is that in Hilbert space of dimensionality 3 or greater, that function has to be of the form trace rho p for some density operator rho. And so the content of Gleason's theorem is that if you give me the structure of measurements, and you tell me it's quantum, right? The projectors have the quantum structure, then it follows that the probabilities of outcomes have to go by Born's rule using density operators. So you get the structure of preparations from the structure of measurements. But it turns out you can prove the opposite inference as well. If instead of starting with the structure of measurements, you start with the structure of preparations, what I'm going to show you is that you can derive that what the structure of measurements has to be. So that'll be next. I should say that starting from Gleason's theorem, you can then prove measurement contextuality. And I don't really want to get into it because I've got limited time. But if you're familiar, you know that you can prove measurement contextuality starting from that. I'm going to just prove preparation contextuality starting from this alternative type of theorem. So the idea, as I said, is to start with the structure of preparations and get the structure of measurements. So here's my starting point. I say consider a function on the density operators now, rather than on the projectors, which satisfies the following conditions. It should be between 0 and 1 for all density operators. And it should be convex linear. So if I have a convex sum of density operators and I evaluate the function, that's the same as taking the sum over wk of the function acting on each density operator, where the wk is some probability distribution. So this function is meant to represent the probability of a particular outcome occurring. So I sort of imagine a particular measurement and a particular outcome. And I say, what's the probability of that thing occurring for all different possible preparations, all different possible density operators? Well, that probability should satisfy these conditions. And then what you can prove is that any function satisfying these conditions has to have the following form. It's trace of the density operator times an effect E. So as Howard was talking about effect algebras, it's just a positive operator less than identity. This is the most general way of representing a measurement outcome in quantum theory. So this actually, this theorem, the proof of it is very similar to the proof of a generalization of Gleason's theorem to unsharp measurements, which you can read about in a paper by Bush or in a paper by Caves, Fuchs, Mann, and Rennes. And so it's basically the dual of this theorem for POVMs. But it's also similar to a theorem that Lucien Hardy proves in a more general context in his axiomatization paper. So I think it's an interesting theorem. It sort of goes the opposite way to the way we usually think about things. And what I want to emphasize is the fact that you can now get a proof of preparation contextuality starting from this theorem in much the same way that you would get a proof of measurement contextuality starting from Gleason's theorem. So first of all, let me remind you that our assumption of a preparation non-contextual hidden variable model was that every density operator receives a single distribution, mu, which I'll call mu sub rho of lambda, not more than one distribution, but just a single one. And of course, at a particular value of lambda, this has to be greater than zero. And as I established a while back in the proof, convex combinations of density operators are represented by convex combinations of the distributions. And so if I think of these things as this mu sub rho of lambda as a function of rho at a fixed value of lambda, it satisfies all the criteria of my reverse Gleason theorem. It satisfies these two assumptions here for the function f. Therefore, by this reverse Gleason theorem, I can always write mu sub rho of lambda as trace of rho times some effect, which I put a subscript lambda, because it might be different for if I use lambda. OK, so now starting from that, I can get a contradiction when I remember that if two density operators are orthogonal, then they have to be represented by disjoint distributions. So it's the same ingredients that went into the previous no-go theorem. So how does this work? Well, take a set of density operators that form an orthogonal basis. So these are the rho k's. And now consider a value of the hidden variable, such that the distribution associated with each of these is zero, except the one associated with row one. So remember, these things have to be disjoint. So at a particular value of lambda, only one of them can be non-zero. So I assume that that's the first one. OK, well, if you think about it, that means that this E of lambda has to be a projector onto psi 1 it has to be proportional. I'm sorry. It has to be proportional to a projector onto psi 1, because that way, trace of any of the other rows, row 2, row 3, row 4, times E of lambda will be 0. So this thing's proportional to a projector onto psi 1. But that means that if I take any other orthogonal basis, so let me define a basis psi k prime, which is, and none of these are collinear with any of these, so it's just some, it could be a mutually unbiased basis, for example. Then if I ask what do the distributions look like for these guys, well, I already know what the effect has to look like at a particular value of lambda. It's just proportional to this projector. So I plug that into this equation, and it tells me that it has to be of the form trace rho k prime times the psi 1. But by definition, these things are not orthogonal or collinear with these guys. And therefore, all of these states are non-orthogonal to the psi 1s, so they're all non-zero. And so that violates this constraint. These distributions were supposed to be disjoint. So that means at a given value of lambda, only one of them could have been non-zero. But I've just proven that they're all non-zero, and I have a contradiction. So this is, if you're familiar with the proof of measurement contextuality starting from Gleason's theorem, this is a very similar structure. OK, you can also come up with statistical proofs of measurement contextuality, which are proofs that are basically dependent on choosing a particular state and that make use of the Born rule. And it turns out you can do something similar for preparation contextuality. This is joint work with Terry Rudolph. And I should say that Terry has a student, Nick Harrigan, who's in the audience somewhere, who's working on these issues. So if you have questions about this, you should ask Nick. So I'm going to just give you one particular example of a statistical proof. And it's based on the same geometry as the example I gave you earlier. So I have the same set of states. But now I'm only going to consider preparation procedures corresponding to convex combinations of pairs of pure states. So the old proof involved triples, like little a, little b, little c. It considered that convex combination. I'm not going to use those anymore. So I'm just going to have these sorts of decompositions. By preparation non-contextuality, that tells me that the associated distributions have to satisfy these equations. All right. Now, I also want to imagine that there's going to be measurements done. So in the previous proof, there was no talk of measurements. Here, I'm going to imagine that I could do a measurement of little a versus big A, little b versus big B, and so on. And remember that the way these measurements are represented is basically partitionings of the state space. They say, you know, is your hidden variable here or here? So I'm going to just depict the whole state space of hidden variables as this box. And the measurement of little a versus big A, I'm going to imagine, just partitions it top to bottom. And little b versus big B partitions it left to right. And little c versus big C is outside versus inside. OK. So now I can make a few observations. So this distribution, mu big A of lambda, has to be 0 in the region of little a. So I'm going to denote this whole region here by S sub little a. So S sub some x is just, you know, whichever region of this diagram corresponds to that x. So I know that this distribution has to be 0 inside this region, because if I do a measurement of little a versus big A, I definitely get the big A outcome. So that means all the weight of that probability distribution has to be down here. But now, if you plug that into this equation up here on the top, this is 0. So if I think of only lambdas in that region, S sub A, this is 0. So in that region, mu sub A is proportional to twice nu. Okay, so mu sub A is twice nu inside that region. Now I can write down an expression for the transition probability, or when I prepare the state little a, and then I measure little b versus big B, what's the probability of getting little b? That has an expression in the hidden variable theory. It's just you've prepared this distribution, mu sub little a, and now you're asking, is it in the region little b? So it's just the integral of mu sub a in that region. And so we know what mu little a looks like. It's 2 nu of lambda. And so I can now just integrate this function in, you know, the region of overlap between the little b and the place where mu sub a has non-zero support, this region. So it's just this region. I integrate it up in here to find my answer. So that's just the region SB intersected with the region SA. And if I think of these numbers here, that's just S1 union S2, the sum of these two regions. OK. So what it means is if I just define now the integral of this 2 nu in all 8 of these regions to be W sub 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, then this expression is just W1 plus W2. It's the integral of this in this region plus this region. That's it. That's the transition probability from little a to b. And now I can do something similar for the transition probability from little b to big C. So I just look here. Here's the little b region. It's on the left. The big C region is the inside circle. The overlap is the 2 and 6 regions. So this has to be W2 plus W6. The transition from big C to big A is the inside circle overlapped with the bottom. So it's 6 and 8. So this is just W6 plus W8. So I could go on and derive transition probabilities, but this is all I'm going to need. All right, so let me just rewrite those three expressions. And now note that if I subtract the middle one from the sum of the other two, the W2s cancel and the W6s cancel. So I'm just left with W1 plus W8. But those things were integrals of positive functions, so they have to be positive. So this combination of transition probabilities has to be positive. OK, so now I'm steps away from contradiction. You probably know what's coming. If I ask what the quantum predictions for those transition probabilities are between the state little a and the measurement that has outcome little b, I find a quarter. Between little b and big C, it's 3/4. There's big C is here, and little b is here. So these ones are close together. These ones are further apart. So this is 3/4. This is a quarter when you work it out. So if you take a quarter minus 3/4 plus a quarter, you get negative a quarter, which is not greater than 0. So your preparation non-contextual hidden variable model cannot reproduce the quantum predictions. So what's nice about this is that we're used to seeing this kind of proof in the context of non-locality. We're used to seeing Bell inequalities. This is very similar to a Bell inequality derivation. But now this is when this inequality is violated, what it proves is not non-locality. What it proves is preparation contextuality. And you can come up with similar proofs for measurement contextuality. Right. OK, so I'm almost at the end, right? What, how much time have I got left, Doc? OK, so maybe I'll go quickly through this and not explain it in full detail. But it turns out that, if you're familiar with measurement contextuality, you may know that one can derive proofs of Bell's theorem starting from proofs of measurement contextuality. So I can often justify my assumptions of non-contextuality by assumptions of locality. So if all my assumptions of non-contextuality are justified by locality, and those assumptions of non-contextuality yield a contradiction, then that contradiction tells me that locality must be ruled out. And so you can do something similar with preparation non-contextuality. There are proofs of preparation contextuality wherein all the assumptions I've made, all the non-contextuality assumptions I've made, can be justified by locality, such that when I derive a contradiction, it implies that locality must fail. So how to see this? Well, if you think about the first proof I gave you, you might think that this could be promoted to a proof of non-locality. And the argument goes something like this. Start with a maximally entangled state. Now imagine doing measurements of little a versus big A on this qubit, or little b versus big B. And imagine that it's the 0, 0 plus 1, 1 entangled state. Then you collapse this guy to little a, big A, or little b, big B, depending on what measurement I did here. So a way of preparing all these different states is by steering, by remotely doing a measurement. Chris was talking about this, where you collapse to one or the other. And then if I just forget about what outcome I got on this measurement, then what I should be left over with here is exactly the same distribution. In the hidden variable model, all this measurement could possibly lead me to do is update the original marginal distribution describing my information in one of many ways. So different measurements could lead me to update that information in different ways. But it shouldn't affect what that distribution is. If I find that through doing a measurement here in some spatially separated location, I affect this overall distribution, what it tells me is that you're actually affecting the ontic states, the hidden variables, over here non-locally. So that was the assumption of preparation ontotextuality, that it was the same distribution on the left of all these equations. And so it seems I can justify that by locality in this scenario where these preparations are made by steering. So that seems like it works out, but there's a problem. And the problem is that there's a second assumption of non-contextuality that I wasn't so explicit about, which is that this mu little a and this mu little a have to be the same. But in this new scenario I'm imagining, they correspond to different procedures. This guy happens when, on my maximum entangled state, I measure little a versus big A, and I collapse to that this outcome, the sigma little a. And this one here occurs when I measure the trine POVM on this guy and collapse to little a, little b, or little c over here. And so there's no reason to think that the distribution associated with getting the first outcome in one measurement and the first outcome in this trine measurement ought to be the same. I cannot justify that by locality. And so this proof cannot be promoted to a proof of non-locality. But the second proof I showed you can, because remember, it didn't have those convex decompositions involving three elements. It had only these simple two-element convex decompositions. And so the only non-contextuality that I had to apply in the whole proof was in assuming that the left-hand sides of these equations were all equal. And that I can justify by locality. And so all the non-contextuality that went into this proof can be justified by locality. Therefore, the contradiction that I derive is also a contradiction with the assumption of locality. So the inference goes locality to preparation non-contextuality to contradiction. So I have a proof of non-locality. Sorry, that was kind of fast. But anyway, the punchline is you have a similar relation between preparation contextuality and non-locality as you do for measurement contextuality. Now, there's another interesting relation, which is that if you give me any bipartite Bell type proof of non-locality, it turns out that that is a proof of preparation contextuality. And the proof of that is due to John Barrett. So if you're interested in hearing about that, you should ask John. And I'm going to wrap up because I think I only have a couple of minutes left. There's lots of other things you can explore in this field. So it turns out that I've been focusing on this idea of non-contextuality in quantum mechanics. But this notion of operational equivalence of two procedures can be applied to any theory. So you can develop a notion of contextuality for any theory. So if you have some toy model or some theory you're interested in, and you want to be able to say, is it contextual or not, there's a definition you can use. And you can also generalize this notion to unsharp measurements, to transformations, and even for preparations, there are more notions of context. So instead of just saying I have two density operators that arise through different pure state ensembles, they could be density operators arising as marginals of two different entangled states. So there's lots of ways two density operators could be the same despite their preparation procedures being different. So you can explore the possibilities of no-go theorems in those sorts of contexts. You can show that every proof of preparation contextuality that's based on this ambiguity of mixtures, like the two I showed you, also yields a proof of contextuality for unsharp measurements. You can show that there's a connection between Horn's problem and proofs of contextuality for unsharp measurements, and this, you know, the list of other interesting connections goes on. So I just want to leave you with a few open questions for you to ponder. I've got different questions for the quantum logicians as opposed to the quantum information theorists. So for the quantum logicians, it seems to me the natural question is, does preparation contextuality have a natural expression within the convex set approach to quantum logic? So I know very little about this, but all I know is in Beltrametti and Casanelli's book, where they refer to Mielnik's work. And so it seems to me that there ought to be some statement, some crisp statement about the convex set of quantum states that should capture this notion of preparation contextuality. Secondly, you know, does contextuality for unsharp measurements or transformations have a natural expression in quantum logic, in any particular logic you're looking at? And another question is, what sorts of theories besides quantum mechanics are contextual in any one of these senses, using the operational definition that I've provided? So it'd be nice to know, you know, here's a class of theories that are contextual that, you know, aren't quantum mechanics, and how are they different from quantum mechanics? That would be very interesting. And then on the information theory side, it seems to me an interesting question is to ask whether contextuality is important for any of the information theoretic advantages that we have in quantum theory. So the best candidate, to my mind, that we know right now is random access codes. You can take a look at Ernesto Galvao's thesis, where he discusses the connection between random access codes and contextuality. But also, it seems to me that the exponential speedup, if there is one, is a natural candidate for something that might derive ultimately from the contextuality of quantum theory. And then finally, if you're interested in quantum foundations, then it seems to me the really pressing question is, you know, what is contextuality? Is there some simple physical principle which implies contextuality? It has this rich structure. Could it be that it really captures some simple physical principle? I suspect that it does, but I have no idea what that principle is. So that's it.